Everyone, welcome to The Law. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet, 7 days a week. For more information about The Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And The Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on an AIDS update right after this message. Well, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, just like it has for thousands of years, but public business is conducted in commercial paper. That's relatively new over the past 100 years. We use things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, and debt and usury. Now, back in 1965, Congress said by law that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin versus clad coin or currency. And you know that's very true when you deal with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real world, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper money and a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on paper money over gold and silver coin. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew as a matter of law that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order to establish our property rights. Well, neither did the Congress and the politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew full well back in 1933 that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first need to take away their gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property and then destroy their property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. And let me teach you how to do just that in my business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home study. Now, for more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, entertaining, educational, and it's free of charge. You can call right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the webpage georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that same free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, what's going on in the world of AIDS, anyway? AIDS has gone pandemic. The United Nations has told us that AIDS is a worldwide disease. Epidemic means that it's in a local area and out of control. When it gets to be worldwide and it's out of control, it's called a pandemic. AIDS travels around the world easily because people fly from place to place. People travel today more than at any time in world history. And people who travel from New York carrying AIDS can carry the AIDS virus too and give it to somebody in London, Paris, Hong Kong, Tokyo, or any place else in the world, or vice versa, as we saw with the SARS epidemic, when people coming from China to Canada and people from Canada to the United States were bringing SARS right along with them. Well, now in the United Kingdom, newly diagnosed cases of the human immunodeficiency virus, it's called HIV, increased by 20% between 2000 and 2003. Almost a third of the 50,000 people currently living with HIV in the UK are still unaware that they're infected. So a third of the people in the UK who have it don't know that they have it. And that's because it takes up to 10 years for the HIV virus to manifest symptoms. So if you contracted HIV a year, 5 years, maybe even as much as 10 years ago, you may not be showing any symptoms yet. And during this period of time, you could have been giving this disease to many other people. Last year, the global AIDS pandemic claimed an estimated 3 million lives, and an estimated 5 million people acquired HIV, bringing to 40 million the estimated number of men, women, and children worldwide now living with the AIDS virus. In looking at some of the HIV statistics, as of the end of 2003, an estimated 40 million people now worldwide, 37 million adults and about 3 million children, have AIDS. Approximately two-thirds of these people live in the sub-Sahara region of Africa. Another 20% live in Asia and the Pacific. Now, worldwide, approximately 11 out of every 1,000 adults aged 15 to 49 are HIV infected in sub-Sahara Africa. It's 8% of all of the adults in this age group that are HIV infected. An estimated 5 million new infections occur worldwide during 2003. That's about 14,000 new infections each and every day. More than 95% of these new infections occurred in developing countries, and nearly 50% were among females. In 2003, approximately 2,000 children under the age of 15 and 6,000 young people, 15 to 24, became infected each and every day. And in 2003 alone, HIV-associated illnesses caused the deaths of approximately 3 million people worldwide, including an estimated 500,000 children younger than 15 years. Now, the numbers here are low, and that's because when you die from pneumonia, unless you've been charted as having had HIV, which would make it HIV-related but not HIV-caused, your statistic then is going to be entered as, well, this guy died from pneumonia. HIV simply means that your immune system is so low that an opportunistic disease such as pneumonia or hepatitis or something else has killed you first. Now, there are many more people who have HIV who are dying from other diseases that we don't know about, and approximately a third of people who now have HIV don't know it. So you could add one-third to these numbers. If you got 40 million people so far infected around the world, just add another third to that, people that don't know that they're HIV infected. So a third of 40 million would be another 13 million people, and so that takes us up to 50. Now, that's not the important thing. It's how fast is the disease growing geometrically? How often does it double? That's the key. And it's doubling every few years. In South Africa, for instance, they started off, I've got some numbers here on South Africa. In 1992, they had less than 1% of the population of South Africa infected with AIDS. In the first 10 years from 1982, when it first surfaced here in the United States, until 1992, the South Africans had less than 1% of their population infected. Today, it's 26%. And if it continues to grow at that rate, it'll infect everybody in the country over the next 20 years or so. That's pretty scary. That's on the order of, or maybe even greater than, the Black Death of the 1348 Black Death in Europe, which killed about 100 million people. That's pretty significant. Now, the lowest incidence of AIDS in the world is in Cuba. I thought I'd point that out to you. The lowest incidence in the spread of AIDS is in Cuba. That's because they practice quarantine there. No other nation in the world practices quarantine, and it's out of control everywhere in the world, which tells me that every country in the world has a policy to advance the spread of HIV, which fits with the New World Order plan to decimate the population of the world by 90% over the next 50 to 60 years. That comes out of the Club of Rome. I believe firmly that AIDS is simply a methodology for population reduction. Now, here in the United States, AIDS is remaining relatively static. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that about 850,000 to 950,000 people are living with HIV infection, about a quarter of whom are unaware of their infection. Now, approximately 40,000 new HIV infections occur each year in the United States, and about 70% among about 70% among men and 30% among women. Of these newly infected people, about half are younger than 25 years of age. Of new infections among men in the United States, the CDC estimates that approximately 60% of men were infected through homosexual sex, 25% through drug use, needles, and 15% through heterosexual sex. Of newly infected men, approximately 50% are black, 30% are white, 20% are Hispanic, and a small percentage are other racial groups. Of new infections among women in the United States, the CDC estimates that approximately 75% of women were infected through heterosexual sex and 25% through drug injection use. Of the newly infected women, approximately 64% are black. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of numbers here and statistics. The point I'm making is that we're increasing at the rate of about 40,000 a year. Most of them are black and Hispanic. They represent about 70% of the new cases. And it occurs about half the time or more in people that are under the age of 25. The point I want to make is this, that AIDS is a penalty. AIDS is a disease. Disease is a penalty that's given to us by God, the creator of the universe, this wild card that nobody pays much attention to anymore, because of sin. Sin is a crime. Sin is a violation of the law. I wanted to point out here that in order for you to get AIDS, you have to be practicing sodomy. That's number one, sodomy. Sodomy is a capital felony, which is prohibited by the laws in the scripture. So people who practice sodomy have an average lifespan, that is men practicing sodomy, have an average lifespan of 45 unless they contract AIDS, and then the average lifespan is 39. So even if there weren't AIDS here, the average lifespan of homosexuals would be 45, but with the advent of AIDS, it is lowered from 45 to 39. Now, that'll tell you a little story. The average lifespan of people from the scripture is 70 years. Under the terms of the contract out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 25,550 days of disease-free life. Now, we're all going to die. But you're entitled to die after you get to be 70 years old. Now, the average lifespan in the United States is 75 and a half years, so you should, on average, die at age 75. Remember, the sodomites are dying at age 45. Now, that ought to tell you a little bit of the story. Because they practice this criminal behavior, they die young. There's a penalty that has to be paid. Now, one of the things that I've noticed here in the United States is that taxpayers pick up the tab on AIDS research. Did you notice that? And I'm here to ask the question, why should George Gordon pay for research into the cause of AIDS or the cure for AIDS? Think about that now for a second and say, well, because it's the Christian thing to do. Wait a minute. I thought Christians subscribed to the Bible, you know, the Judeo-Christian ethic, and that you're getting your doctrines, your law, your beliefs from the Bible, which tells you that sodomy is a capital felony, for which you were supposed to take the sodomites out and stone them to death. That way, none of these sodomites would ever get AIDS, because as soon as you catch them, you take them out and kill them. Well, now, that's not kinder and gentler, and so we've made sodomy in the United States civil rights protected event or issue, and so we're not stoning people for this capital felony. And therefore, these people then go out and practice their nefarious conduct, which then develops into disease and threatens the rest of us. Now, this is where the rest of the story comes in, because you'll notice that 15% of the people that are contracting AIDS now are heterosexual. Now, does that mean that husbands are going out and practicing sodomy and then coming home and giving it to their wives? Does that mean that the sodomites in our midst are giving blood, and then when people go to the hospital and they have surgery, they get tainted blood? There's been a number of cases like that. In fact, they even tell us that if you're practicing a sodomite, that you're not to give blood. Well, do you suppose that maybe there might be some sodomites that give blood anyway? When they're asked the question, are you homosexual, they answer the question, oh, no, of course not. And I don't know. I don't take blood, so I'm just pointing this out, that blood transfusions and there are other ways to get AIDS. There's other transmission vectors, but primarily it's through sexual conduct. Now, let me raise another wild and crazy issue. There's no such thing as sexual relations outside of marriage. Well, that ought to just blow your socks off. No such thing as sexual relations outside of marriage without a penalty. Crime has a penalty. If there was no penalty, there wouldn't be a crime. You can't have a law without a penalty. So when God comes along and says, thou shalt not commit adultery, and you go out and practice sodomy, which is an adultery crime, it's a sex crime, of which there are many, that's just one, then there has to be a penalty. The penalty for adultery is death, and in almost all sex crimes there's death, you know, gonorrhea and syphilis, sexually transmitted diseases like venereal warts and chlamydia and some other diseases. Now, along comes the CDC and medical research, and they say, well, listen, it used to be a death sentence when you got gonorrhea or syphilis, you know, but not anymore. See, now we've got sulfa drugs and penicillin and antibiotics, and so now we can cure AIDS. We can cure VD. We can't cure all sexually transmitted diseases, but gonorrhea and syphilis we can. So therefore, we can sell forgiveness of sin, and we've been doing that. And so after we got through with syphilis and gonorrhea, now comes AIDS. Now what are you going to do? And I submit to you that when we come up with a cure for AIDS, God will send another disease along, something that's more virulent than AIDS. And then what are you going to do? It would seem like to me that we ought to be teaching people abstinence and law and order, thou shalt not commit adultery, rather than teaching people, oh, that's all right, go ahead and commit adultery, but use a condom. Go ahead and commit adultery, but let's practice safe sex. That's like saying, let's go ahead and break the law, but let's do it so that we don't get caught. It just seems like to me we'd be money ahead if we taught people to obey the law rather than break the law. I'll leave it up to you to draw your own conclusion. Now, the thing that I'm objecting to is that the government wants me to pay taxes. Fortunately, under our constitutional system, we can elect to participate in these programs through Social Security and income tax, or we can forbear. I decided I wanted to forbear. I'm one of the few guys in the country that's not complaining. But it would seem like to me that if the government's going to spend $2-4 billion a year looking for a cure for AIDS, the government is a part and parcel with the crime. In other words, it's our Surgeon General who came up with this neat idea to educate children in sex education in school to use condoms and to preach the doctrine of alternative lifestyle. I can't for the life of me see the logic in alternative lifestyle and teaching children sodomy in public school at taxpayer expense. That's why I dropped out of that program. Now, I'm not opposed to the rest of you doing that. I mean, if you want to send your child to public school and have your child taught sex education and alternative lifestyle, I mean, that's your business. I mean, after all, I guess you got a right to do that. I don't think it's right, and I don't think it's good for your child, and ultimately I don't think it's good for you, but that's a choice that you make, and there's a penalty that has to be paid. So when your child comes home and they have venereal disease or they have AIDS, it looks like to me the parents who send their children to public school to educate them to this kind of swill are the proximate cause of their own injury, aren't they? Now, years ago, I used to complain a lot because I was paying income tax. I had 30 people working for me, and I was paying about $200,000 a year in taxes. And I felt pretty bad about that. I didn't like it, especially when I saw these ACT UP guys. You know, ACT UP, I forgot the acronym now, but it was people with AIDS that wanted the government to do more to find a cure for AIDS. What they're really saying is, we want to break the law, and we want a remedy for it. We don't want to pay the penalty. We want to speed, but we don't want to get speeding tickets. You know, we want to break all the laws, but we don't want to have to pay any penalties. The rest of you people have to obey the law, but we're above the law, and we don't have to do that. Well, AIDS is a penalty for breaking the law, and I don't think that people who contract AIDS are above the law. Now, besides sodomy, blood use, drug use come into play. The scripture tells us, you shall not eat blood. We Americans don't eat very much, but we mainline a whole lot more. And we like to stick it in our veins with a needle and run blood in there. Now, we were told not to eat it. I can't imagine how sticking it directly into your vein circumvents the law that prohibits the consumption of blood through your mouth. It could be circumvented by consumption of blood through intravenous transfusion. Mull that one over, and then ask yourself, do you think that that's really, really worth it? Do you really want to take that risk? And then the other side of the coin is, when we go into the hospital and have an operation, there's a prohibition against making cuttings and markings on your body. And I kind of figured that when somebody was cutting a hole in your stomach there to remove the baby, you know, with a cesarean section, or maybe they're going to cut out your appendix or something on that order, that maybe there were cuttings being made that might necessitate some bleeding, which might necessitate some blood transfusion, which, again, violates the blood law. Here's my point. Did you notice that in each and every one of these scenarios that there's a violation of one of these biblical laws, like eating blood, making cuttings or markings on your body, or practicing sodomy or bestiality or some other nefarious sexual activity, which then inevitably comes down with AIDS? And then these people with AIDS come to you and I, and they say, well, gee, we're really unfortunate. You know, I'm a sex worker. We used to call sex workers whores. Today we call them sex workers, you know, kind of like they're garbage men, they're sanitation engineers, or the, you know, they're just a normal part of the workforce. Whoredom is prohibited in the scripture. And so you've got all these prostitutes running around, and of course they contract AIDS, and then they pass it on to their Johns, their customers, they call them, Johns. And so, here again, you've got another crime. Now, anybody that would go to a whore is an accessory before and after the fact, isn't it? I mean, you walk up to this woman, and she says, for $100, you know, I'll let you have a little on Friday night. Now, you knew before, and then after you go do it, now you knew she was a whore, and you paid her $100. Oh, excuse me, I'm terribly sorry. You knew she was a sex worker, you paid her $100, and aren't you then the proximate cause of your own injury when you come down with AIDS? And yet these people who are out here violating these laws are coming to you and me, the taxpayers, and saying, hey, we want you to donate money so that we can come up with a cure for AIDS, so that we can go out and continue on with our criminal behavior. You know, you and I, the average Joe Sixpack, you know, married and have a flock of kids, you know, we're not out to Flo's Whorehouse, and we're not frequenting the Democratic National Convention or the Republican Convention, where all the horrors are going to descend during those conventions. We're the stay-at-home types, you know, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, and we're not practicing sodomy, bestiality, or some other sexually promiscuous activity, high risk, they call that. You know, we're the good guys. And yet we're supposed to pay for this? Well, I decided some years back that I wasn't going to pay for it. Now, I'm not opposed to anybody else that wants to. I mean, that's your choice in life, and you can do that if you want, but I thought I'd forbear. Now, AIDS is spreading around the world. For instance, over in Thailand, and they estimate that 2% of the population is now infected. And it's spread rapidly, they say here in the article, by female sex workers and their clients, whores and their johns. And then we have Burma, Cambodia, about 3% of the adult populations in those two countries. China, 1% of the population. Now, that translates into quite a few people, because 1% of 1.3 billion, you know, quite a little chunk of people there. So China now is a big wild card, along with India, because they're afraid that when the pandemic really gets cracking over there, there's a numbers game that comes into play. Once you get a number of people infected with this, then those people infect other people, and those people infect other people. When it's growing 1, 2, 4, 8, it isn't very significant, but when it gets up to 100, 200, 400, 800, 1600, then it starts to get, you know, when it gets to 1 million, 2 million, 4 million, 8 million, and 16 million, now we're starting to log, aren't we? And all of a sudden now, this really gets to be serious, and you need to take it seriously, because our government here in the United States does not quarantine people who are sick. we leave those people out in the general population so that they can continue on infecting other people. You know, there's privacy concerns that we have to take into consideration. Privacy concerns? Not exactly sure why it is that we're concerned about the privacy of people that are packing a deadly disease, but we are. Now, in Cuba, they treat it a little differently. They treat it scripturally. I don't know why Fidel Castro is following the quarantine law, but that came from the law of Moses, this idea of quarantine. And then we've got intravenous drug users. Now, drugs, of and by themselves, are called the art of the apothecary in the scripture. It's a part and parcel with witchcraft. Witchcraft is prohibited. Witchcraft is punishable by death. And sure enough, these people that are practicing this intravenous drug use, they are indeed killing themselves by practicing this form of witchcraft. You know, most of us don't do that. Most of us aren't down on the street corner, you know, buying a rock of coke or crack, and we're not shooting up with heroin or smoking dope, but there are people out there that do that. They depress their immune systems, and then they have unprotected sex, and they come down with AIDS or hepatitis or some other disease, and then we're supposed to feel real sorry for them and then pay for their treatment at taxpayer expense. I mean, here are people that go out and commit a crime, they contract a penalty, and then they're asking you and me to come in here and pay the fine for them. And I'm just really not too keen on that idea. HIV infection in adolescents and young adults. The AIDS epidemic among adolescents and young adults in the United States continues to be an increasing concern. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported 40,000 cumulative cases of AIDS among people ages 13 through 24. So it's the young people in the society that are contracting AIDS. Then there's the exposure and transmission. Most of the HIV-infected adolescents and young adults are exposed to the virus through sexual intercourse. Where do 15, 16, 18-year-old boys learn sexual intercourse? Is that in sex education in public school? And since most of it comes from sodomites, is it that they're learning sodomy and they're going out and getting infected with their sodomy contacts? You know, the alternative lifestyle? And then they want me to support and finance the public schools so that I can support and finance sodomy, so that I can support and finance the scientists in their attempt to find a cure or a vaccine for AIDS, so that I can do my part to promote this kind of sexual licentiousness and crime. I don't want to participate in that. You know, I kind of like to back off. Hang on. We'll talk a little more about this when we come back. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by the Gordon Law School. All of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out of Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush Sr. back in 1992 when he was running for re-election, and George Bush Jr. in 2000 when he was running for election, and now in 2004 running for re-election, all of these Bushes are telling Americans that what we want is jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognize that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called property. It's not measured in employment. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. And that's because there's no money in public business. There's no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you and I cashed in on our inheritance and learned how to collect these benefits of the Old Covenant contract, and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. To collect those benefits in property, real property, instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults, and then order my free general law CD package at the same time. Now remember, the CD package is free of charge. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, entertaining, it's educational, and remember, it's free. You can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, send me an email, and order the free general law CD package. That's the first step. Doesn't cost you anything. Only takes a minute. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about HIV and crime, an AIDS update. You know, the Taliban, you know, those Muslim extremists in Afghanistan who were teamed up with Osama bin Laden, the wicked, evil, bad, nasty Taliban. I'm non-political, and I'm not arguing about their political ideology, but I wanted to point something out that maybe you hadn't heard. and that is that the Taliban government, this radical fundamentalist Muslim government, had virtually eliminated the poppy or the opium trade in Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan is the largest producer of opium poppies in the world. They have been for many years. And when the Taliban came in, they took over and eradicated it. They took it down from 200,000 acres a year to less than 4,000 acres in 2001, their last year in office. Then the United States came in, and we threw the Taliban out. And the opium production has gone from 4,000 acres to 150,000 acres in 2002 or 2003. Oh, yeah, that's right. It was about 50,000 acres in 2002, 150,000 in 2003, and it's 200,000 acres in 2004. So under the American occupation in Afghanistan, we have totally restored the opium trade in Afghanistan, the opium production. Now, we have in this country a program which is called the War on Drugs. What I can't understand is how a bunch of Bedouins, a bunch of sand jockeys, who are a bunch of, you know, just radical religious fanatics, can stamp out the drug trade in Afghanistan. Stamp it out. And we, the United States of America, with all of our sophistication technology, you know, satellites in the sky, and all of the tanks and all of the troops, we can't do it. Now, I know that the Taliban is a bunch of bad guys, but, you know, maybe if we could get those Taliban guys over here now that they're unemployed in Afghanistan, maybe put them in to our war on drugs, and maybe they know something that we don't know. I mean, after all, they did succeed where we have totally failed. Which leads me to believe that I don't think that the American government, the U.S. government, is really interested in this war on drugs to eliminate drugs. I think that that's window dressing to cover up the drug trade. You see, you can't just run around telling people, I'm a medical doctor, and I want you to get sick, number one, and then I want to keep you sick so that I can make a lot of money off of you. I mean, hell, if a doctor told you the truth, you wouldn't go back to him. So the doctor says to you, oh, I am so sorry that you're sick. Come right on in here and let me help you get well. I've got these good medicines over here, and let me help. They're kind of like government agents. You know, I'm from the government. I'm here to help. You know, at some point in time, you know, even stupidity has to see through some of this nonsense, doesn't it? Now, approximately 25% of the cases of sexually transmitted infections reported in the United States each year are among teenagers. Now, 25% of this AIDS is in teenagers. This is particularly significant because the risk of HIV transmission increases substantially if either partner is infected with an STI. Now, that's a sexually transmitted disease. Discharge of pus and mucus as a result of STIs such as gonorrhea, chlamydia infection also increases the risk of HIV transmission 3 to 5 times. And likewise, STI-induced ulcers from syphilis or genital herpes increases the risk of HIV transmission 9 times. And then, when it comes to treatment, the adolescents and young adults tend to think that they're invincible, and therefore they deny any risk. This belief may cause them to engage in risky behavior, delaying HIV testing. And if they test positive, delay or refuse treatment. And I think that's pretty significant. Let's suppose we got an 18-year-old kid here, say, and he comes down with, oh, let's say, syphilis. He goes to the doctor. The doctor tests him and says, well, son, you got syphilis and you got HIV, or you got genital warts, or and you've got HIV, and the kid says, well, I'm going to deny that I've got it, and I'm going to delay treatment. Well, let's suppose this kid, he's 18, he delays treatment for 1 year. So here you got an 18-year-old boy who's sexually active, who's in denial, and he's going to delay treatment for 12 months. What do you think he's doing during that 12-month period? Practicing celibacy with the Catholic priests? Or do you think maybe he's out sexually active with his girlfriend and, well, gosh, since he's been to sex education and alternative lifestyles in high school, maybe he's out with his boyfriend, Bob. Let me ask you this. Do you think this kid who's in denial is telling his girlfriend, now, Mabel, I have HIV. I went to the doctor and I was tested and I test positive. So let's get in the back seat and have a little. Or do you think maybe he doesn't tell Mabel? He doesn't say anything to Mabel and they have sex and maybe Mabel comes down with HIV. You know, I'm kind of suspicious about this whole concept. When you tell me that this kid is going to delay or refuse treatment, you know, I'm from a different era. I'm like Mork from Mork. I came from a period of time in history here in the United States when if you went to a doctor and the doctor said, oh my God, you've got syphilis, they ain't letting you out of the office. They're going to quarantine you. And furthermore, they're gonna call the police and they're gonna start an investigation and they're gonna go around to everybody that you might have had sexual relations with, you know, like who are your girlfriends and boyfriends, and because in the old days we wanted to eradicate these diseases. I think today our government policy is to spread these diseases, and indeed these diseases are spreading. We're getting higher and higher disease rates. And you'd think that we Americans, with all of our vaunted medical technology and our great strides forward in medicine, you know, you'd think that we'd have Oh, things like tuberculosis, you know, under control, but it's not. It's growing. And you'd think we'd have syphilis and gonorrhea under control. No, it's spreading. It was less 30 years ago than it is today. Why is that? Is it because you let Tom out of the doctor's office because he wanted to delay or refuse treatment? Doctors report that many young people, when they learn that they're HIV positive, take several months to accept their diagnosis and return for treatment. What are they doing during that seven or several months that they're refusing treatment? God, that don't make any sense to me. Does that make sense to you? And that's why we behave kind of strangely here at the school. In other words, our lifestyle here is aimed at quarantine, and we have to quarantine ourselves from you, the general public. See, I'm not running around asking you if I can take a swig off of your beer bottle. I don't want to exchange body fluids with you. I know that that's rude and obnoxious. But when I was a kid, that was called Health and Hygiene 101. You know, I learned that when I think I was in about the third grade. Don't drink off of little Bobby's Coke bottle, things like that. Otherwise, you might get measles or mumps or infantago or something like that. And so we were pretty careful about exchanging body fluids, you know, things like saliva. You know, I wouldn't have thought when I was a kid growing up that you'd put your child in a daycare center. I mean, you got people, you know, that are rushing off to work. You know, you mothers out there, I mean, you know, you got work to do, and I can understand that. I sympathize with you. And you got this little baby, and he's maybe, you know, 6 months or a year old, and you drop him off here at the daycare center, and your little baby, you know, puts everything that he can into his mouth, and this little kid, you know, he's walking, running around on the floor. Now, how many of the other babies in this daycare center come from parents who have AIDS, and how many of these babies maybe are HIV positive? And they're putting blocks and thingies in their mouths, and then your kid comes along and puts those blocks and thingies in their mouth, and then they tell us that this HIV is not communicable through, you know, such things as saliva and casual contact and things like that. Well, okay. Well, let me ask you this. Let's suppose that you're at work, and you know, the guy that works next to your cubicle here in this big office, you know, he come out of the closet, and maybe he's HIV positive, and he has AIDS, and maybe he's drinking a Coke, and then you want to go over and you say, Bob, let me have a drink off your Coke bottle. Would you do that? Or would you say, well, gosh, that sounds like it's kind of high risk to me. Again, you know, I don't want to tell you whose Coke bottle to drink off of. I'm just throwing out a couple ideas to you, you know, and then maybe you'll start thinking about it. And I just can't see any logic to putting my kid into a daycare center along with other people that are HIV positive. It would seem like to me that the Cubans who have the lowest incidence of HIV and the lowest incidence of contagion or communication in the world, practicing quarantine, they take those people and put them in a sanitarium like we used to do with people in this country that had TB. I know it isn't kind and it isn't gentle, but it protects the rest of the population from getting infected. And down in Cuba, if they found this 15-year-old boy or 18-year-old boy that wants to go into denial and say, well, gee, I don't believe I've got HIV and I'm going to delay treatment, they just snap him right off the streets and stick him in a sanitarium and start his treatment, whether he liked it or not. And they would keep him away from your daughter, Mabel. Now, it just seems like to me that the old-timey days when we used to teach teenagers that sexual relations belong in marriage, and that when you get married, we'll talk about sex and sexual relations and reproduction and things like that, but prior to marriage, we don't think that that's a very good idea. We think that you ought to be warned against that. And we used to have good girls and naughty girls. And of course, if you're going to have good girls and bad girls, then you got to have good boys and bad boys. So I thought I'd share that with you here on this AIDS update because, you know, we're the proximate cause of our own injury a lot of times. Now, here's a few things that I think are bad policy. The reason that we practice this concept of delaying and refusing treatment, doctors report that many young people, when they learn that they're HIV positive, take several months to accept their diagnosis and return for treatment. Healthcare providers may be able to help these adolescents and young adults understand their situation during visits by ensuring confidentiality and explaining the information clearly and eliciting questions and emphasizing the success of newly available treatments. But what if this young fellow says, why don't you go to hell? I'm not going to do it. Do we just let this guy walk out the door and go infect other people? See, I just don't see the logic behind that. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has developed documents that address the standard of care for the treatment of HIV, including information about how to treat HIV in adolescents. According to the guidelines, adolescents exposed to HIV sexually or by way of injection drugs use appear to follow a clinical course that is more similar to HIV disease in adults than in children. And then they've got clinical trials over here, and they've got all kinds of real neat, nice, gosh, we're kinder and gentler than we've ever been. But it doesn't prevent the spread. It doesn't prevent these people from going out and giving it to others. And that's the point I wanted to make. Now, this HIV in minority populations, in the racial and ethnic minority populations in the United States, primarily African Americans and Hispanics, constitutes 61% of the more than 830,000 cases of AIDS reported to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Since the epidemic began back in 1981, African Americans make up 41% of all AIDS cases reported in the United States. And yet, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, they comprise only 12% of the U.S. population. So here's 12% of the people that make up 40% of the disease. Now, it would seem like to me that these people ought to be better informed, don't you? I noticed that a lot of black people go to church. What happened to the preachers and teachers in these churches and organizations? Shouldn't those people, those teachers, those sky pilots and holy joes, be teaching these people about, you know, about thou shalt not commit adultery? I know it's kind of a wild new concept in theological circles, but don't you think that would tend to go a lot further than practice safe sex and let's have alternative lifestyles? And I mean, these people are paying a penalty, aren't they? That's why I believe very strongly that people should see the other side of the coin. All right, we ate the fruit off of the forbidden tree in the Garden of Eden. Now our minds have been opened, and now we've got knowledge. We know good and evil. Don't you think maybe we ought to teach you the good as well as the evil? I mean, now that you're teaching sodomy in the public schools, don't you think maybe you ought to counteract that by saying, all right, boys and girls, now there's the evil, but let me show you the good that comes from practicing thou shalt not commit adultery, so they can at least make an informed decision. Isn't that what choice is all about? But I notice that we don't have that kind of choice in the public schools. You cannot bring in thou shalt not commit adultery in the public schools. But you can bring in sodomy in the public schools. You know, just somehow along the line, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But then people want to send their children to public schools, and it would send a strong signal to me that maybe you ought to jerk your kid out of there. Would you send your child to or into harm's way in Iraq? Well, you know, you could send your kid to Baghdad and he'd stand less chance of getting killed or injured there than he will in your public school. Did you know that? Yeah, yeah. Crime in the public schools is quite a story of and by itself. I've reported that more than once on this program. I can't for the life of me understand why people would want to send their children to a public school where they're more likely to be assaulted, more likely to come down with a sexually transmitted disease, more likely to be killed, diseased, than they would be if they went into a war zone, and you wouldn't think of sending your kid to a war zone. But you send them to public school. So there's the story on minorities, and it's not just with the blacks, it's also with Hispanics. And why should the taxpayers underwrite this crime? You know, grants are awarded to all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. In fiscal year 2002, two additional jurisdictions in the Pacific, the Marshall Islands and Northern Marianas, received funds. Congress earmarks funds that must be used for the ADAP. It's an important distinction since other Title II spending decisions are made locally. The ADAP earmark is by far the fastest growing component of CARE Act appropriations. It has increased more than 1,000% over the past 5 years, from $52 million in 96 to $639 million in 2002. But total ADAP spending is even higher, since state ADAPs also receive money from their respective states and other CARE Act programs and through cost-saving strategies. All right, now let me tell you a story here. I was looking at the numbers here. Do you know what it costs to treat AIDS here in the United States? Well, from the time you get it to the time you die, it costs about $12,000 a year for medication. And you're going to die in about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And so it's going to cost about $100,000. Now, the people over in Africa can't afford that kind of money, so they get their drugs over there for $140 a year. Now, if we've got drugs for $140 a year, $140 in Africa, same drugs, they call them generics over there, well then, why don't we go over, you know, why doesn't this government agency here, I mean, if we're going to underwrite, subsidize, and treat these criminals who now have AIDS, criminal? I mean, there might be one or two people in there that actually got AIDS who are innocent, who didn't violate the laws of God and came down with AIDS. Kind of makes me wonder how they'd get AIDS if they were practicing quarantine, but then, you know, maybe it happened. But by and large, most of these people are making bad choices by practicing alternative lifestyles, making bad choices with intravenous drug use and sharing dirty needles and taking blood transfusions and going through hospitals and having operations and so on. All of these are violations of the Mosaic Law. And they go out and break these laws, and they come down with AIDS, and then they come to you and me and they say, well, we want you to pay for our drug care. Okay, let's suppose that we need to pay for their drug care. Let's grant that. Why should we have to pay $12,000 a year for the drug care of these welfare indigent recipients on the government dole in the United States, when the United States is putting up $15 billion a year to buy the same drugs for people in South Africa, Namibia, and other countries of the world for $140 a year? Well, somebody says, well, the pharmaceutical companies, you know, they got to make a profit so that they can look for new drugs. Okay. Well, then, why don't we, now that the drug companies have developed these drugs, why don't you just write them a check for $1 billion? Okay, here's your profit. Now, if you can manufacture these drugs and sell them at a profit for $140 a year, then go ahead and do that. But now we've paid you your profit. Now, why do we need to pay $12,000 a year? You know, how much profit is profitable? I mean, we've already subsidized these drug companies through taxes. And did you notice that on the Medicare deal, you know, the U.S. government can't buy these drugs at a discount. They have to pay full bore retail plus 10. I'm not deaf, dumb, and blind. I'm an old-timey businessman, and it would seem like to me that anybody could negotiate a better contract than that. Now, Congress didn't negotiate that contract because they're stupid. They negotiated that contract because it was a payoff to the drug and the pharmaceutical industry. You know, that's another reason that kind of turns me off on being a taxpayer and joining the system and just going out there and being Joe Sixpack nice guy. When I see these kinds of inequities, I say to myself, you know, if you people want to live that kind of lifestyle, and if you people want to come down with these kinds of diseases, it seems like to me you ought to pay for it. If you want to speed and break the law, I don't think that I should be compelled to have to pay my tax money to pay your fines and to make you whole again. You know, when you're the proximate cause of your own injury, it looks like to me that you ought to pay the piper. The drug industry controls the Congress. Let's just be intelligent about it. Now, that's what we call free choice. And I really like the United States of America because the people who have social security numbers and want to participate in the tax system and want to participate in the system and want to participate in the American way have a right to do that. And those of us that are dissidents, those of us that don't want a social security number, don't want to subsidize crime and don't want to participate in the AIDS programs, can opt out. And I'm one of those that opted out. And if you've thought about opting out, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? Let me tell you a little bit more about that. Our Constitution gives us the right to choose. And my job is to give you the opportunity to see what that choice is so that you can make the choice. I don't think anybody's ever given you an opportunity to make a choice. Well, we're about out of time. The Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information on the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, why don't you go to my webpage? That's georgegordon.org. And the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-profit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement only. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. So for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school, or the law hour rather, is carried worldwide on the internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal that says our time is up. We'll have to leave it right there. So I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.